Tonight we conclude the annual lecture series by teacher, author, and Nobel Peace Prize winner Elie Wiesel of Boston University. This evening we'll hear In the Talmud, The Orchard, A Dangerous Adventure, the last of the three lectures in the series. To introduce Professor Wiesel, here is the rabbi to the Jewish community at Boston University, Joseph Pollack, who also directs the B'nai B'rith Hillel Foundation. Rabbi Pollack.
Evening. My name is Joseph Pollack, one of the rabbis at Boston University. I'd like to welcome you here. The Talmud brings up the case of a woman who has committed a capital crime and who has been sentenced to death by the courts. May her husband remarry, the Talmud inquires, even before she's actually executed, so long as her sentence has been passed. He may, comes the reply, for there is no legal distinction between one who is sentenced to death and one actually dead. With the passing of her sentence, she has ceased to exist as a legal entity in this life. As Jews gather for worship this Saturday, they will read how Abraham sent his trusted servant, Eliezer, to seek a wife for Isaac. Now, Isaac, according to the Midrash, was almost 40 years old when Eliezer was sent on this expedition. 40 years old. In the shtetl, which was last week's topic, they would have said, an alter bacher, an old bachelor. Why didn't Isaac get married earlier? Because when, in the earlier biblical episode, God commands Abraham to kill Isaac, Isaac's legal reality was already altered. He too was a condemned man. His sentence had been uttered. He was legally dead until Abraham's trial was over. Only then could he marry. All survivors of the world of the night were condemned to death. They stand like Isaac, waiting where the night meets the dawn, never altogether certain that the sentence has been lifted, and like the biblical Eliezer, repeating their tale again and again so they can marvel at it and get a glimpse of the orchard where all the ones who were executed wait. From Eliezer to Eliezer, there has been no teller of tales like Eliezer. And among the survivors, no one has had greater courage to explore the orchard than has Eliezer. Ladies and gentlemen, it gives me great pleasure to introduce Eliezer Wiesel.
Tanu Rabbanan, this is what our teachers have taught us. Arba'a nichnesu lepardes. Four sages entered the orchard. That is the opening line of a disturbing passage in the Tractate Chagiga, which we plan to study again and again tonight. We have tried to explore its hidden meaning when we discuss the lives of its four participants, but it is never enough. Each time I reread this short text, I find it more perturbing and more rewarding. On the surface, it is the tale of a failed adventure whose exact nature has not been revealed to us. All we know is the outcome. Rabbi Shimon ben Azai looked and died. Rabbi Shimon ben Zoma looked and lost his mind. Elisha ben Abuya looked and lost his faith. Only the fourth, Rabbi Akiva, left the orchard in peace. A later reference to Rabbi Akiva is somewhat richer, for it suggests a kind of apotheosis. Allah b'shalom, he ascended in peace, ve'yarad b'shalom, and he descended in peace. The text does not tell us much about the orchard itself, though it is clear from the telling that it was not a real orchard with fruit trees. What was it then? Something else? The term exists already in the Song of Songs. In the Septuaginta, it is translated as paradise, and a place surrounded by a fence. It is then a distant world, a secret sanctuary to which the initiated alone are admitted. And what did the four sages seek to discover upon entering in its inaccessible and invisible grounds? Forbidden knowledge, original insight, some new experience perhaps, uncharted paths for the soul, new vistas for its eternal longing. But how does one get into the pardes, the orchard? Rashi, our great, friendly, and eternally obliging commentator, simply states that it is simple. He said that names played an important role. Names may be used as ladders to climb up to the heavens. But even Rashi suggests that they used a name to ascend into heaven or into the paradise, into the pardes. But even his help is not sufficient, for we are not given to understand whether they ascended into the pardes physically or figuratively. In other words, bodily they may have remained grounded in reality, but their souls went up to higher heights to come closer to God's mysteries contained in the orchard. And the Tosafists seem to be less subtle. They believe, and they say so, that the four sages did not ascend anywhere. They just thought they did. At this point, may I open our customary parenthesis. First, words of gratitude to Rabbi Polak for his comments, for reminding us that my real name in Hebrew is Eliezer, and it's a good name. Also for telling me that Eliezer the First was a good storyteller. He was such a good storyteller that he became a good matchmaker, and I wish I had that profession as well. And also Rabbi Polak, who attains and accomplishes educational miracles in his work for students at Boston University. And this is the last encounter this year, so I must thank my colleagues in the departments of philosophy, religious studies, and university professors, all distinguished in their fields, all devoted to their intellectual goals. I like to thank my able office assistant, Marta, to my TAs, Charlotte and Greg, for their knowledge, and to those who handle the physical and technical arrangements for these encounters with tact, with strength and devotion. And they are from the Office of All University Functions, Jody Anderson, Amy Bottomley, Judith Sandonato, and the student ushers, who were from the president's hosts. One more preliminary remark. In my last lecture, I misspoke twice. I mentioned the blood libels in previous centuries when Jews were outrageously accused of killing children for Passover matzah. And in the improvised remark, I said that they were accused of killing Jewish children. No, they were accused of killing Christian children. Also, I spoke about Christians in today's Boston who organized protests against Israel, which I found misplaced, misguided, and unfair. And I said that they were both Episcopalians and some Catholics. They were only Episcopalians. The Catholics, in this case, remained neutral, which is not something which I would condone. I'm against neutrality when we deal in morality. But nevertheless, the Episcopalians went a bit too far. And they did not go too far into the orchard, rather away from it. Let's go back to the orchard. What then is the paradise? What is it really? A dream? A vision? An inner castle a la Kafka, forever unreachable? Generally, it is defined by its four initials, pshat, or simple interpretation, drash, elaboration by metaphor, remes, or explanation through hints, allusions, and sot, or the approach by secret initiations. Like some of you, I have always been attracted to and fascinated by the strange story and its illustrious protagonists. I read it and reread it numerous times, sensing each time that there was some aspect I have failed to notice, and hoping that I might stumble upon something that I needed to find without really knowing what it was. Usually I studied Talmud with a smile, and I learned it from my late teacher and great friend, Rabbeinu Shaul Lieberman Zal. Not this story. This story, I approach it not with a smile, but with renewed fear and trembling. Need I repeat tonight what I have tried to say here at least for 26 years? For me, Talmud is a consuming passion. All its sages, wherever they are and whoever they are, they all speak to me. I wish I could become a disciple of each one of them. From Shammai, I learned the importance of rigor, and from Hillel, the value of moderation and even compassion. I believe to be Shammai for myself and Hillel for the other. Talmud means study. To study Talmud is to study. In other words, one never stops studying. Just as Torah has no beginning, the Talmud has no end. For 2,000 odd years, it is given to us to add a commentary here, a hypothesis there, a question leading to another question, and to move a step forward by looking backward. Talmud also means dialogue. The entire corpus is nothing else, an endless series of sometimes heated, other times gentle conversations between sages and disciples. Some are separated by centuries, and yet one has the feeling that they are all sitting at the same table, although in those times they sat on benches, on semi-circles, in amphitheaters, looking into the eyes of one another so as to better understand. How many people realize that Talmud also means tolerance, or the word I prefer, respect? The minority enjoys all the privileges of the majority. Both positions on all possible subjects, whether practical or theological, are recorded for eternity. Even the vanquished ones are recorded. We love Hillel, but respect Shammai. And our respect for him is no less profound. So to study Talmud means to celebrate it and to be in touch with the bottomless memory in which death alone is mute. Talmud to me is also my childhood, an image, an old teacher, Zaida the Melamed and his pupils in a small room, study at the pale light of a kerosene lamp. Seated at a rectangular table, we follow him beyond mountains and oceans to Babylon, from there to the Galilee, and even to Jerusalem, where we attend the stormy debates between Rabbi Eliezer, known for his severity, and Rabbi Yeshua, famous for his spirit of conciliation. We follow Rabbi Zeira to the land of Israel, and Rabbi Shimon ben Yochai and his son to their hiding place, and pray for their safety, for they were always threatened by the Romans. With my friends, we study in sing-song the laws concerning the sanctity of the Sabbath. It is forbidden to light a candle, for it involves work, and the Sabbath was made for peace, not for work. It is equally forbidden to blow out the candle, but there is always a but in Talmudic text. What if I blow out the candle because I am scared, or because of the enemy, or because I'm afraid of robbers, or if I watch over a sick person who cannot fall asleep? In that case, the prohibition is lifted. To save life, any life, everything is permitted. One might say that large portions of the Talmud deal with ways of saving human life and human dignity, always and everywhere. Which brings us naturally to current events, these days, days of terror and violence in many parts of our turbulent planet. It is incumbent upon us to remember the overall importance of using our strength, defending freedom from its enemies, wherever they are, and wherever terror exists. It must be fought and defeated. This is why we gather here year after year to study together. Even what transpired in the orchard of forbidden knowledge, yes, even that. After all, it was an event that was so formidable that it transformed the lives of those who participated in it. In his study of this episode, Gershom Scholem, the great scholar who turned mysticism into an academic discipline, attributes the fourth interpretation of the word pardes to the renowned medieval Kabbalist Rabbi Moshe de Leon, who deals with it in his penetrating volume Chochmat HaNefesh, or The Wise Soul. We are, of course, interested mainly in the fourth approach, which is the mystery. Mystery as a way of grasping truth, which is the vertical approach, not the horizontal one. In fact, it is the way the story is related in the Tractate Chagiga, as part of the chapter called Ein Dorshin, Things One Must Not Study. Let's look at it a bit closer. Ein Dorshin Barayot Bishlosha means, according to Rashi, one is not supposed to discuss matters related to sexuality in the presence of two other persons. Today you would of course ask, may you discuss sexuality in the presence of 2 million people? 20 million people. If you want good ratings, introduce sexuality in anything. The same text, Chagiga, continues and says, Ein Dorshin B'Maseh Bereshit B'Shnayim. One is not permitted to discuss questions related to the mystery of the beginning of creation with another person. And it continues, V'lo B'Merkava B'Yachit, nor may one study God's act in history, God's action in human affairs, even alone. Thus, it is generally believed that the four sages entered the orchard, meaning the world of forbidden knowledge, seeking mystical experiences, not necessarily the understanding of Maaseh Bereshit or creation, but God's role in history, the Merkava. Meaning, we must be careful when study this chapter, because there are dangers awaiting us inside. That the Merkava theme, which means God's action in history, the theme of that action, is dominant in this tale is clear by its placement. It belongs to a passage that tells the story of Rabbi Yochanan ben Zakkai, who was the master of masters in Talmudic literature, who was riding a donkey followed on foot by his disciple Rabbi Eleazar ben Arad. Rabbi says, said the disciple, teach me something about the mystery of the holy chariot or Merkava? Answered the old teacher, haven't I taught you that one must not deal with this subject even with one, except if he is mature and wise already? Said the disciple, Rabbi, would you allow me to say something that I have learned from you? Say it, replied the old master, who immediately descended and sat down on a rock under an oil tree. And Rabbi Eliezer wandered around. The disciple said, why did you get down, Rabbi? And the teacher answered, it is possible that while you will speak about the mysteries of Merkava, the Shekhinah, the divine providence, will be with us, and angels from heaven will accompany us, and I should be riding on a donkey. So Rabbi Eliezer began speaking, and suddenly a fire came down from heaven and encircled all the trees in the field, which began singing God's glory. Did the four learned conspirators experience similar miracles while inside the Pardes? Furthermore, again, the question is, how did they get in? Did they possess a key to the gates? They did. In other words, before acquiring mystical knowledge, they already had some of it. That's what Rashi seems to believe while suggesting that they used a mystical name which allowed them to ascend to the higher spheres of creation. Did they undertake the journey, the perilous journey, alone? They could have, especially since they were not supposed to discuss matters among themselves. Yet they did enter the paradise or the Pardes together. We know that from what had been said inside. So, how did they organize themselves? As a clandestine group, Rabbi Akiva seems to have been the leader. Was it because he was wiser, older, calmer, more erudite? Had he been there before? Actually, he knew what to expect to find inside. In fact, he warned his fellow travelers what to say and especially what not to say. It is in a midrash about the celestial palaces called the Heichalot. And he said, when you will reach the site of pure marble, Rabbi Akiva told his companions, do not shout, water, water. According to some commentators, what he meant to say was, do not be afraid of being unable to cross so much water, just continue. Others attribute a higher meaning to his warning. Were all three careless? Did they fall into a trap laid by hostile forces? Did they go too far? Did they see what mortals are forbidden to see? Did they find answers the human mind is incapable of grasping? Many commentators believe the goal of the conspirators was to understand the grave problem of theodicy. Why do just people suffer, whereas the wicked seem happy? Furthermore, why are the people of Israel continuously subjected to so many persecutions? That question has been a major preoccupation in various scholarly circles. Remember, those were anguishing times for the Jewish people. The Second Temple was in ruins, the kingdom of Judah in distress, and its young valiant defenders deported to various places in the empire. Hope was rare and joy scarce. Of all the nations vanquished and dominated by Rome, Judah, in spite of its small size, it was probably the smallest province of the Roman Empire. Judah was the most troublesome to Rome. It represented a permanent challenge that military might could not ignore, let alone eliminate. Thus, the emperor's legions adopted a policy of cruel oppression aimed at stifling, if not annihilating, the Jewish spirit. Titus ransacked the temple and penetrated the Holy of Holies, to which the high priest alone had access one day a year, on Yom Kippur. Titus profaned it by spreading the sacred curtain, the parochet, on the floor and making love to a prostitute on it. In doing so, his goal was clear: to humiliate the Jews, although his verbal insult was addressed to God. Strangely enough, he was convinced, Titus, the general, was convinced that inside the Holy of Holies there was a person or a God, and that person would come and prevent him from doing things or insult him or do something. He couldn't understand that there was nobody there. Nobody. That God was invisible. Among the fanatic rulers, Hadrian was probably the worst. His nickname was Wicked. He commissioned an altar to Jupiter to be erected in Jerusalem, which he renamed Aelia Capitolina. His decrees had been unequaled even in times when anti-Jewish practices were commonplace. During his reign, Jews were forbidden to reside in Jerusalem or even to visit it. Only once a year, on Tisha B'Av, the ninth day of Av, the day the temple was set aflame, they were allowed to come and see it from a distance. Why? The text says it. To make them weep harder. All imaginable methods were utilized to shame and torment Jews so as to move them to abdicate their faith and to give up hope. Seductive promises accompanied the threats. It was possible for a Jew to renounce his allegiance to the God of Israel and immediately become a Roman citizen with all the rights and privileges accorded to native-born Romans. For a Jew wanting to live as a Jew, life was dangerous. The observance of Shabbat, capital punishment. Circumcision, capital punishment. Study and teaching Torah, capital punishment. To ordain rabbis meant to expose both sides to torture and execution, both teachers and pupils. Nevertheless, teachers and students managed to enrich themselves by clinging to the treasures of learning and wisdom. One of my favorite and most moving images is from a place named Usha. An appeal was issued there and was heard from one corner of the land to another. Kol shelamat sheyavo v'yelamed. Whoever studied, let him come and teach. Veshelo lamat sheyavo v'yelmat. Whoever has not studied, let him come and study. When did all that take place? Actually, it took place in the era of the armed uprising of Bar Kokhba. We know now that Hadrian in the beginning was friendly to the Jews. We had it many times in our history. Muhammad in the beginning was friendly to the Jews. Luther in the beginning was friendly to the Jews. Hadrian was friendly to the Jews. It is said that he wanted actually to rebuild the temple himself. Under certain conditions, if they would accept really an idol in the temple and to give up circumcision. One could be, therefore, forced to ask the question, is that the reason why four illustrious sages chose to enter the orchard of forbidden knowledge, just to find an urgent yet plausible answer to the eternal question of why God has given so much power to the pagan enemy and such profound suffering to his faithful people? Actually, in this light, one may view the tale of the Pardes or the orchard as a Talmudic attempt to examine possible human responses to suffering. One could be madness. Madness as both refuge and rebellion. When pain becomes unbearable, its rejection can be either physical or mental. Just as the heart may give up, so may the mind. Inability to understand excessive pain, your own or that of someone else, moves you to renounce all that is rational. You just know that you can take it no longer. And thus, insanity may take over. That is what happened to Rabbi Shimon ben Zoma. He tzitz venivga. He looked where he shouldn't have looked and lost his mind. Then there is escape of a different kind. Escape into nothingness, since nothing matters anymore. Escape into death. Whether as a result of logical reflection or sudden impulse, you give up on the world and its blind fury, and on life with its impossible hope. You say goodbye and let someone else continue the struggle for truth and redemption. That is what may have happened to Rabbi Shimon ben Azai. He sits the mate. He looked and died. Except that his death was not a suicide. It was a punishment. His death was also a consequence of an answer to transgression. He shouldn't have confronted danger by entering the dangerous ground of the orchard. There is also the response of rebellion. Just say no. When suffering, again your own, or especially the suffering of someone you love, reaches a certain level, you simply and courageously refuse to accept its human inevitability and within the context of divine justice. And you say, I very well am aware of certain facts of life. I know that some people suffer whereas others do not. I also know that some people suffer more than others. Perhaps I am too weak to change that. Still, I am strong enough to raise my voice to protest and declare to all who are willing to hear, I refuse to believe that there is justice in all that. Someone is unfair, and his ways are unjust. Is this Elisha ben Abuya's response? Yes and no. We shall return to his apparent paradox later, but finally, there is a fourth option. Faith. Faith in spite of suffering. Faith instead of suffering. Faith against suffering. Faith to the last breath, like Rabbi Akiva's. His end is known. As is known the end of the so-called Acher, the other, Elisha ben Abuya, who represents the opposing pole, the sage who turned renegade. But what about the demise of their two companions, one who died and the other one who lost his sanity? I so wish we could find in Talmudic sources more about the way Ben Azai and Ben Zoma departed. What did Ben Zoma say when he was still lucid, a moment before his mind deserted him? What did Ben Azai say when he realized that his hours were numbered? Who were these four sages? We have had occasion to discuss their life and work in years past. And abundant literature is available to us on every one of them. But what was the nature of their relationship? Clearly, Rabbi Akiva was the teacher. What about the others? Were they friends inside the orchard or outside the classroom? They surely were familiar with one another, for they belonged to Talmudic academies, and the academies always knew what was happening in each. Each academy had a librarian. And the librarian actually was the archive, and he learned everything by heart. The librarian was someone who knew everything by heart. At that time, to own a book meant to know it by heart. And there were special librarians in every academy who remembered by heart. They were supposed to be not too bright. They were known for their memory, but nothing else. Because the sages were afraid if he's too intelligent, he would add things that weren't said by others. They were supposed to be, forgive me, a kind of living computers of the time. Computers don't think. So they belonged to academies, and therefore each knew what the other was saying, what aspirations they all had. Whatever was said reverberated everywhere. They had points of reference and acquaintances in common. Anyway, they were close enough to undertake a perilous and awe-inspiring journey together. Let's start quickly with Ben Azai. What do we know about him? Briefly, born in the Galilee in the 2nd century, he was known to have studied with such fervor, so close to ecstasy, that once as he and his disciples studied Torah, not only mystical ideas, a fire descended from heaven and enveloped them. We have that image all the time, that a fire came down from heaven, the fire from Sinai. That means when you study with such fervor, with such fire, that there is a kind of sacred fire that comes and envelops you as well. He was admired for his scholarship, but was never ordained. Engaged to Rabbi Akiba's daughter, it is unclear whether they got married and divorced, or simply broke off the engagement. Was it clear that he suffered on account of it? Probably. Once Ben Azai was present at a discussion on the implication of celibacy. Whoever has no child is like one guilty of bloodshed, said Rabbi Eliezer. Rabbi Yaakov went further. Whoever is childless is like one who diminishes the image of God. For it is written that God created man in his image. Whereupon Ben Azai chose to intervene by conveniently pronouncing both of them right. Whoever has no child is like the one who sheds human blood and diminishes the image of God. At that point, Rabbi Eliezer Ben Azaria felt compelled to correct him. Look who is talking. Meaning, what does he know about children? He wasn't even married. And he continued, some speak well and act well. You speak well, but your deeds, your behavior contradict your words. Embarrassed, Ben Azai had to defend himself and said, what can I do? My soul is in love with Torah. How can one fail to be touched by this statement? Love of Torah is no less essential for our lives than the love of God. However, in our Birkat HaChodesh, the blessing for the new moon, we pray for long life, peace, honorability, but also a month filled with love of Torah and Yirat Shamayim, fear of heaven. For obviously they must go together. Love of learning, love of Torah, and fear of heaven must go together. Indeed, it is possible to conceive of someone so totally in love with the teaching of Torah that he forgets his obligations towards his fellow human beings. And that is wrong. To oppose the law of God to the love of his children is to abuse them both. Love of Torah is no total excuse. A friend of mine who was a very great rabbinic scholar said to me, speaking about fanatics, if I take the holy scrolls and use them to kill somebody who doesn't agree with me, I'm a murderer. One can use the Torah for the wrong purpose. Naturally, that is not what Ben Azai meant or do to say. His humanism is best reflected in his own interpretation of the biblical commandment, V'ahavta l'reacha kamocha, thou shalt love thy fellow man as yourself, which, in Rabbi Akiba's view, represents the high point of ethical conduct. Not so in Ben Azai's. He believes in the preeminence of another biblical verse. It is from Genesis. Ze sefer toldot Adam. This is the book of the origin of humankind. For Ben Azai, what is important for us to remember is that we all have the same beginnings. Thus, we are all equally worthy in the eyes of our Creator. Isn't that the exultant principle of universality to be found in the Torah? What is so astounding is that Ben Azai had the moral strength to formulate this inspiring lesson at a time when his people, our people, endured terrible anguish and suffering at the hands of the Romans. Question. Is this why he entered the orchard? Is it possible that unlike his teacher and his companions, he sought to solve the mystery not of the end, but of the beginning? Did he wish to understand how two persons or two groups who share the same origins can turn into tormentors on one side and victims on the other? Still, even so, in his private life, the question of his celibacy remains open. Doesn't the Torah command men to marry and bring children into God's world? Is this why he entered the orchard? Not only to explore the deeper secrets of Torah, but also to reconcile its possible contradictions. For the world to continue, it must be inhabited by men and women. That is clear. But says Ben Azai, the world will go on thanks to others. Is that a proper response? Even an explanation? Is it possible that Ben Azai refused to have children because of another principle, one that had been proposed by some sages, namely that in times of destruction, when God inflicts punishment on creation, one must not go against his will by bringing children into this world? In other words, is it possible that Ben Azai took God's words or the interpretation of his words too seriously, or at least too literally, saying, since God punishes the world, that means I shouldn't have children? Whatever he discovered in the orchard of forbidden knowledge has not been revealed to us. But whatever it was said. Listen to his melancholy advice. Whoever remembers these four things will be saved from sin. Where do you come from? From darkness. Where are you going? To darkness. By whom shall you be judged? By the King of Kings, Creator of the universe, blessed be He, who knows everything and owns everything and can be neither flattered nor cheated. Where do you go? To hell and nothingness. He died childless, either as a young man of 20, according to one source, or in his 40s, according to another, still young, because he had been already a teacher. How did he die? When and where did he die? Of what? While still in the orchard? In the presence of his companions? In the immense universe of the Talmud, his quest for ultimate answers to eternal questions remains a source of light and warmth. What about his friend Shimon ben Zoma? We know that he did not die in the orchard. But what made him join the conspiracy leading to the Pardes in the first place? Also a bachelor, also a brilliant scholar at the Yavne Academy, also denied ordination. There are a few laws, very few bearing his name, few decisions attributed to him. From his sayings, one may imagine that he was quiet, self-possessed, and serene. He considered himself fortunate compared to the biblical first man, Adam. For him, he said, to eat bread, he had to sow and reap, prepare the dough, bake bread. I have everything ready-made. He also said, who is wise? One who learns from each and every person. Who is strong? One who can dominate his instincts, impulses, and passions. Who is wealthy? One who is satisfied with what he has. Who is honored? One who honors his fellow man. He also insisted on self-control. Commenting on a biblical verse, he said, do not glimpse another man's vineyard. If you did, don't enter it. If you entered, don't look. If you looked, don't touch the grapes. If you did, don't eat them. If you did eat them, you are lost. A man with his rationalist personality, pragmatic nature and temperament, what in the world was he looking for in the orchard? Is it that he wanted to bring changes in his life and in his outlook on life? Is it that he had reached the limits of reason and inner peace and now felt the desire to see what lay beyond them? In simpler words, did he enter the orchard because he was looking for madness? May I repeat what I must have said here years ago? All four sages in the Pardes puzzle me, but each in his own way for different reasons. Ben Zoma intrigues and frightens me. There is something about him that eludes me. A learned sage in torment, that much I understand. A sage in revolt, that too I understand. But a pious sage who loses his mind, right from the start he aroused my interest. And some of you can surely guess why. Madness, and particularly mystical madness, is after all present in most of my novels, if not in all of them. Is it possible that Ben Zoma, without noticing it, without me noticing it, managed to slip into my stories in disguise, uninvited? Is it possible that just as he has belonged to my world, some of my characters belong to his? These are difficult personal questions, and there are not many clues. A few anecdotes, some parables and sayings, not much more. Still, there is one tale we should explore. It tells of an encounter between Ben Zoma and his teacher, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania. And the story is told in the Talmud four times in different versions. The first: one day, Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania found himself on the steps of the temple. Ben Zoma greeted him but did not stand. The master addressed him in a typical Talmudic fashion, which is short and incisive. Men ainu le'an, Ben Zoma. Where do you come from and where are you going, son of Zoma? And the disciple answered, I was meditating on the mystery of creation. Scripture speaks of the waters above and the waters below with almost no separation, as it is written, and the Spirit of God hovered over the waters. It reminds me of the turtle dove hovering over its young without touching them. Which is very poetic. But the master said to his disciples around, Ben Zoma is still outside, meaning outside his senses. The second version is slightly different. This time Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania was walking along the road and he met Ben Zoma, who didn't greet him. A disciple should greet his teacher. Again the master asked him where he was coming from and where he was going. And Ben Zoma spoke again on creation and the waters. This time the master commented, Ben Zoma is already outside. In the third version, Ben Zoma is already on the other side of sanity. We can imagine him disoriented, pursuing thoughts that carry him far away, neither seeing nor hearing anybody, following other voices, playing with other images, his spirit wandering through time and space. And listen how it is told in Talmudic text. Seated, lost in thought, Ben Zoma doesn't notice his master who greets him. He doesn't even notice him. The master says something to him, he doesn't respond. The master greets him a second time, and still Ben Zoma, the disciple, doesn't answer. The master greets him a third time, and now Ben Zoma answers, but he looks panic-stricken. Rabbi Yeshua ben Hanania asks him, "Menayin haraglaim?" Which could mean many things, from where are you coming from? Or what are you doing at this moment? I was thinking, replies Ben Zoma and stops. At which point the master cries out, as heaven and earth are my witnesses, I shall not move from here until you have told me the source of your thoughts. Only then does Ben Zoma answer, I was meditating on what separated the waters above and the waters below, time of creation. Commented Rabbi Yeshua, Ben Zoma is already gone. And in fact, Ben Zoma died a few days later. And this story, too, remains in the collective memory that is Talmud. We learn from it that certain mysteries cannot be approached with impurity. Which brings us to the third sage, Elisha ben Abuya, nicknamed Acher, or the Other. Like the other three, he was a great scholar, a teacher of Rabbi Meir. He may have had his own academy. The fact that he was a younger companion and friend of Rabbi Akiva speaks volumes about his own status in the community of learning in Jerusalem. He entered the orchard and kitzeitz binetuot. He cut down the fledglings, which means he lost his faith. More precisely, he rejected his faith. What had he seen there that provoked such a crisis in him? One legend has it that inside the orchard he saw the angel Matatron, whose mission is to record all the virtues and good deeds of all living Jews every day. How is it, he cried out, that we have learned that no one ever needs to sit in heaven, for no fatigue exists there. But I myself saw the angel Metatron sitting while writing down the good deeds of the Jews. And here comes the verse. He said, is it possible that there are two powers, two authorities that govern the world? That means he lost his faith in God. In other Talmudic texts, the origins of his rage are similar and more concrete. One day when Elisha ben Abuya was in the valley of Genesar meditating, he noticed a man climbing a date tree on Shabbat in order to dislodge a bird's nest. The man left the baby bird and took away the mother, and nothing happened to him. He went home safe and sound. That same night after Shabbat, Elisha saw another man climbing another date tree where there was another bird's nest. And this man freed the mother, but took away the baby birds. And when he touched the ground, he was beaten by a snake and died. Well, it is written in Scripture, if you should encounter a bird's nest in a tree or on the ground, free the mother and take care of the little ones. Thus, the man who transgressed the law remained alive, whereas the other who observed it died. Elisha's anger is understandable, isn't it? A similar story adds an important element to the scene. The man who sent the baby mother away did so upon the instruction of his own father. Or both commandments promise a reward, long life. Said Elisha, is this the good man's reward? There is no judge and no justice in this world. A variation of the same theme. During the Roman persecutions, he saw the tongue of the famous Chutzpit, the interpreter, dragged through the dust by a pig. And he cried out, Elisha cried out, this tongue that was spreading pearls of Torah, here it is desecrated. He suffered so much that he turned to sin and became a changed person, a renegade. Oh, we included his case in the list of possible responses to extreme suffering. Is anger a valid response? It is not. Eventually, the son of Abuya did go too far. He collaborated with the enemy. That too, regretfully, has in some cases become a possible response. The worst, the one we must reject. Let me try to elaborate. Can suffering change a person? Or does it dramatically bring out a part of weakness that is already in him? Was his penetrating the orchard a pretext to rebel against his own past? Whatever the answer, the new Elisha, in his anger at God, turned against his own people. He tried to influence Jewish youngsters to give up their study. He also became an informer. Nothing can justify such behavior. We shall conclude the list with Rabbi Akiva, who remains one of the pillars of the Talmud. After all, he alone emerged from the paradise or from the pardes unscathed. Whatever he had seen, heard, and experienced there had no effect on his inner self. Allah b'shalom, b'yarad b'shalom. He ascended in peace and descended in peace. Once outside, he could turn the page and continue as before, teaching Torah to multitudes until he was caught by the Romans, who put him to death in the marketplace. His response to suffering? Kiddush Hashem, the sanctification of God's name. Certain areas of his life remain shrouded in mystery, especially his relationship with a military hero whose legend has moved generations of Jews to resistance and martyrdom. In the year 134-135 of the Common Era, did Rabbi Akiva support the armed rebellion led by a charismatic young general named Bar Kokhba? He did. Did he call him Messiah, even though Bar Kokhba himself spoke of himself as Nasi, president? He did that too. Was he the only sage to lend support to the revolt and its leader? Contradictory answers are found in Talmudic sources. At least one scholar, Rabbi Yochanan, disagreed with Rabbi Akiba, saying, perhaps not without melancholy sarcasm, "Akiba, Akiba, grass will grow in your cheeks," which means you will long be dead, "before the son of David will be here." Did Rabbi Akiba change his mind upon realizing that Bar Kokhba, the son of a star, was actually Bar Kuziba, the son of falsehood? It's possible. Was Bar Kokhba, as we say, good for Jews? Well, he was a good commander. Today, there are opinions in scholarly circles, especially in Israel, who say that he was very bad for us. After all, the price for the 3.5-year insurrection in which Jewish communities in diaspora may have participated, the enemies inflicted unprecedented casualties. But must also be said that Bar Kokhba's little army inflicted heavy casualties on the Romans' legions too. If one is to believe Dio Cassius, the historian, Hadrian was forced to bring 9 legions from abroad, headed by the famous Julius Severus from Britain, to deal with the young rebels. The 10th legion was defeated. The 22nd totally wiped out. So much so that in his victory message to the Senate in Rome, he omitted the traditional expression, "I and the army are well." They weren't well. Still, from the Jewish viewpoint, the heroic resistance was costly. 50 fortresses, 985 villages were destroyed. 580,000 men were killed. Solomon's grave was demolished. Starvation and disease reigned supreme. Corpses were lying in the streets of Beitar for days and days. The Romans made it a crime to bury them. When finally they could be brought to their graves, a special prayer of gratitude, Hatova Hameitiv, was introduced in Birkat Hamazon or after meal grace. Were the spiritual leaders, the heads of academies, the sages responsible for his death? One source says so. It goes as far as claiming that the sages themselves executed him when they realized that he was a false messiah. Other sources maintain that his death was caused by his own hubris.
The symptoms on paper for anthrax are very nonspecific.
With God, saying,
so if you ran into
God,
a case,
don't help
you might not
and don't hurt
recognize
me. Which means
it.
Don't intervene. Let me do it on my own. But what did Rabbi Akiba think? Was his attitude to Bar Kokhba related to his memorable journey to the orchard? Did he view that adventure as a mistake? Is this the reason he accepted his martyrdom with equanimity? His tormentors combed his flesh with iron combs, and he did not cry. He recited the Shema Yisrael, "God is God, God is our God, God." And the text says that his soul left him with the word Echad, when he pronounced the word, "God alone is God, God is one." Ota sha'a, says the text, shat kriyat shma ita. That was the precise time when one is supposed to say the Shema. And my teacher, Lieberman Zalt, wondered, why is this detail emphasized? Why is it so important to know when he recited it? Because it was true. It reveals that even in his last agony, Rabbi Akiba remembered the law governing prayer. Had it not been the time for saying the Shema, he would not have said it. I believe Rabbi Akiba felt close to Bar Kokhba. Rabbi Akiba was already an old man, and Bar Kokhba must have impressed him with his youthful vigor and patriotism. Rabbi Akiba remembered the time when Judea was free, and so he wished to see it free again. Roman oppression grew harsher and harsher, and Bar Kokhba's battle lasted 3.5 years. And so Rabbi Akiba, therefore, wanted to see in him the Messiah, because he felt Israel needs a savior. Israel needs a leader, Israel needs victory. Rabbi Akiva is strange. How could he really believe that the general could be the Messiah? A general? A teacher, yes. A general? Who were Rabbi Akiva's students? Like in later yeshivot, one did not study alone. Each had a partner, a friend. Talmudic sources indicate their number. There were 12,000 pairs. Thus, Rabbi Akiva, the shepherd who at 40 began his informal education, had groomed 24,000 students. Allowance must be made for the usual midrashic exaggeration. We love to exaggerate. However, what is clear, there were many, and all died. All of his students died during the 7 weeks between Passover and Shavuot, what we call the Sefirah, or counting. And that period remains in Jewish life a period for collective mourning. Weddings are not performed, except for Lag BaOmer, one day Lag BaOmer. Music is not played, not even at special occasions. Hair is not cut. And in some communities, work is not done after sunset. Except for Maimonides, most halachic authors speak about that custom that became law. Those 7 weeks, we mourn. We are in a state of mourning. And all the laws of mourning apply to that 7 week period. Strange. Jewish history is not lacking in occasions for mourning. But no period lasts as long as this period. Even our obligation to commemorate the destruction of both temples doesn't span 7 weeks and doesn't impose such harsh prohibitions. There seems to be something special about the Bar Kokhba soldiers. Were they all really his students? Some were Shomronites, because Shomronites too were forbidden to circumcise. Were they Christians? That's a good question. Were there Christians among Bar Kokhba's soldiers? The Christians were persecuted even more harshly than the Jews under the Romans. But they couldn't join Rabbi Akiva in his adoration and admiration for Bar Kokhba, because Bar Kokhba was the Messiah for Rabbi Akiva, and the Jews believed in the Messiah. The Christians had their faith in their Messiah, in Jesus. So therefore, the Christians did not join Bar Kokhba. Others did. How did they die? During the Bar Kokhba rebellion, before or after the passing of Rabbi Akiva? Did they participate in the rebellion? Were the students soldiers? No clear answer is available, but we at least know one thing. One source says there was an epidemic of scarlet fever, which provoked choking. That's how they died. Other sources are more disturbing. They died because they did not respect one another. Says the Midrash more explicitly, they were jealous of one another. And all these explanations disturb me. I don't like them. As a teacher, I don't like them. Is it conceivable that the greatest of all teachers, then Rabbi Akiva, had such students? Would my students be jealous of each other except in grades? But hadn't they learned from Rabbi Akiva the unique of importance of I should love your fellow, your friend, as you love yourself? Had they forgotten so quickly what their teacher had given them? And if all of them misbehaved, all of them, all the 24,000, doesn't it reflect negatively on their master and teacher? Is it possible that their behavior too is somehow linked to his role in the orchard of forbidden knowledge? After all, remember, there were 4 sages who entered the orchard. They enter the same place at the same time, probably for the same reasons. And look at what happened to them. They may have seen, heard, and experienced the same hidden truth. And yet, they reacted differently. One died, another lost his mind. Still another lost his faith. Only the fourth emerged as if nothing had happened. Were the students aware of all this? Did some of them feel resentment, cheated? Did they regret not knowing more about what their teacher had discovered in the episode that left its mark on his life and death? Did they have the sense of having missed out on some essential part of their studies that he had held back something from them? Above all, they wanted so much to know what exactly their great teacher had found inside the orchard. But you know, in mysticism, the rule is clear. Those who know do not speak, and those who speak do not know. What do we learn from this entire episode? Does every generation have its own orchard? Does anyone have the key to ours? Questions remain questions, and the answers are still inside. Thank you.
You have been listening to the last in the annual series of three lectures by Professor Elie Wiesel, holder of the Nobel Peace Prize. Join us next week for another edition of Boston University's World of Ideas. For a cassette of this program, call 1-800-909-9287. Join the conversation on our website at wbur.org. Our webmaster is Angel Cazelli. Tonight's program was produced by Vince Fairchild and Chris Bannon. I'm Ted O'Brien. Thanks for joining us.